Okay, so today we're gonna try and address two of the strongest statements you can have in favor of really creating as much space as possible for the for artists in the film community. The first is Rabbi Yehuda Sarna. So I'm wondering what you guys thought of this piece. Sorry, this is really much more audience reaction than there's no lumbus involved. So what do you guys think? Well, there's one Chakira, right, where he has this dance student that we brought to the Orthodox phone, I believe, who makes the who gives you a very different vision of what halacha is. Halacha is supposed to. Well, let's start with that. There, Miriam, what do you think the Chakira is? What does Rabbi Sarna say that he learned from this dance student that he had not appreciated on the basis of yeshiva?
Direct creativity as opposed to, or spirituality as opposed to creating them.
So what do you think?
About what went on is true.
Are you convinced by his claim that in fact law is supposed to channel and you need to cultivate your inner creativity to the point where it can be channeled? Or can law produce its own spirituality?
I don't know anything about law theory.
You know anything about
law theory.
Yeah? What about your own experience? How do you experience law? Is it channeling your inner creativity or is it producing?
I don't really think of law in terms of creativity generally.
Aha. Okay. The whole category is irrelevant.
Well, it might not be. I just never thought about it.
Do you understand his claim?
I understand it in abstract. I haven't, fleshed it out in my head and tried to think about how it would apply. I don't know if I would understand it if I tried to.
Okay. Jared, what do you think?
I'm not sure if I got it. I mean, we spent a long time. I mean, maybe it was specifically about the fostering creativity section.
Yeah.
But I'm still not sure if I understand exactly what he's saying. That paragraph, specifically when he's talking about tefila, I haven't spent some time talking about it. I'm still not sure if I understand what his point is, what he believes creativity and halacha, how those work. I'm not sure if I get it.
Want to take a shot?
No, so I mean, I don't know. And we were talking about what Didier was talking about how, sort of recreating oneself. I'm not sure if I remember. No, in terms to fit with the tefillah, I mean, when the killing of the words and the words being dead. Really, the first step towards me going back and sort of putting myself into the words and feeling it. I don't know, is that what you were saying? I don't know.
I mean, something like that. Well, it seems right. Well, he uses the phrase "kill the words" because, but it seems more like actually what you need to do is to kill yourself. Right. The idea is. If you say the words so much that they become meaningless to you, and then only by you becoming the character can you make the words really mean what they're actually supposed to mean as said by the character. So really, killing the words is recreating yourself as the person who should be saying the words the way they ought to be said.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a self-creative activity, which is nice.
Yes, Rachel.
I mean, I really resented the paragraph about fostering creativity and how he put down words, and I understand that it's not the way that everyone expresses themselves, and that just as words mean something to me, art might mean something to him. But I felt like I took it very personally that he was saying that, you know, the real work begins outside of it, and sometimes words are long dead, and I feel like you could say that with anything if it hasn't been properly experienced or appreciated, that therefore, and it just...
But that's not what he's saying.
He seemed to be saying that if
he's saying
it
that the power of the words is as an expression of something real that's inside.
But
right? So the words are important because they denote what it is that you're right. What type of person it is that you're supposed to be?
But just as much as art does.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand exactly why he thought part of being a creative Jewish person then that words have to go.
I don't think words in terms of expression in words. I think he meant that sort of the form of the creativity isn't important when you're focusing on the creativity itself. Meaning if you have like a beautiful piece of poetry and you can't speak the language and you're stumbling over the words, you're not really appreciating the method that's coming out of it. And understanding that like the form, the words themselves aren't as relevant to getting the content out of it. The words already have to be coming natural to you.
What do you think of his claim that doing this sort of like performing a piano concerto? Performing a score. That's in the last part of Heschel. Yes. Right. Mitzvah performance is like performing a score. I guess I think of piano, but you could sing it. You could play the flute. So what do you think? Is that a good metaphor? What does it teach? What does it teach?
Well, because a score is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, each measure has a specific note in it. So like each mitzvah is you know, it has a specific level that you have to be fulfilled and it has to, you know, be done by a certain time or in a specific way. But different people playing the same piece on an instrument or singing the same song can sound very, very different because of the way they do it. And and you know, it could be done by rote or it can be done because with like a lot of kavana and a lot of research and have really, really thought about what it is that you're doing, and also for mitzvot, because it's something that is like very, very particular. But it needs to have more than just learning a particular.
I am continually astounded by reading reviews of classical music. I don't get it. So I'm really astounded reading reviews of classical music of how people can claim that performances that use the that are true to the original score are so radically different that you can listen immediately and you can know which orchestra it is and you can know which conductor is with which orchestra and you can talk about how they have totally different understanding of the of the music, even though they're, you know, at the level where it says, oh, it says play this note for this long. How can it be different to play this note for this long? That's one of the, you know, It's one of the fun mysteries of life for me, right? How is it possible that the same score can be produced and that the differences aren't simply produced by errors? That's a fascinating thing to me. As Adina points out, when we recognize the amount of work that goes into producing a worthwhile performance of a classical score. And part of the interesting question underneath it is there any purpose in listening to a mediocre ninth grade student with 3 years of piano lessons performing a concerto? And is there any purpose in their doing it? Or do they get anything out of it other than hopefully learning how to get it right eventually? And getting it right means saying something about, right, playing it in a way that hasn't been played previously. Or it might mean playing it in a way that if you could really exactly recreate the way a great pianist did it, right, that would be worthwhile also. Or at least it would have been before recording. Okay, yes, Emily.
This is kind of a side point, but in music theory this past year, the teacher brought in two of the same piece. One of them was recording of the original, which is worse quality but was recorded like by the original. And the other one was the same piece but a computer program had just converted the score into the song. And he played both of them and asked the class like which one was better. And obviously all these like artsy people were like, oh, the original, because it had so much soul in it.
And, like, I don't know what I personally make of that, but for sure, I mean, that was at least the consensus in the classroom at the minute that it became computerized and kind of about the notes and the musical tonality as opposed to the emotion and feeling behind it, it was completely meaningless.
So that is an interesting, so it's an interesting challenge about whether, whether we're supposed to be musicians playing Judaism. Yes, Rachel.
So I was just going to respond to before Emily's comment. You had said, sort of like, is there a purpose or is it worthwhile that you know, someone who's not proficient in music would be, you know, doing a performance if not just for the sake of one day being good at it? And I sort of feel like, is it there worth in getting it wrong? That there's, that at least for me, like, I place such value on, like, you know, doing my best work. Like, I'm much more proud of the paper I produce before I hand in the grade than when I get it back. Maybe I got an A on the paper, but, like, it doesn't mean as much as it does to me personally, the fact that I feel like I did it right, that I did the best I could. So I sort of feel like, isn't there something to be said for the performer who's an amateur, but, like,
if they get something out of it, I don't know. You know, there's some things I do reasonably well at an amateur level, and so it's valuable, and there's things that I do at an amateur level, and they're just silly unless I get to do them better. Right, the interesting challenge is what happens if you get good enough at something at a particular level. Ping pong, for me. And you get to be, a really good ping pong player of a certain type, and you think there's really, there's really a certain kind of beauty in the way you play ping pong, to the point where actually people come and spectate. To watch you play, and then all of a sudden you meet a Dr. Lee, and just discover that you had no conception of what really good ping pong was. I know people who gave up music, especially once they realized they wouldn't be great at it. I don't know. Mitzvot are not for, mitzvot is not performance art. You don't engage in mitzvot for others. But this is a challenging notion. Heschel says this consistently, right? Heschel says that the purpose of daily davening is to practice. Because someday you'll need to daven, and if you don't practice, you'll never get it right. So Heschel is l'shitaso. I don't know that we want to accept Heschel's theology on that. It's like a version of the position attributed to Ramban about mitzvot nechus la'aretz. Right? Because they're all practice. I don't know that I'm willing to go that far. I also don't know that I'm willing to go that far as to claim that God's first identity is as an artist, but I don't remember the Torah saying specifically artist. Or that to be like God is to experience the tormenting rhythm of creativity. I don't know that I want to describe God as experiencing a tormenting rhythm. I'll leave it up to you whether you find that a powerful theology. Nor is it clear that even if you were to take all the premises as it is, that the outset of that is that one should generate the outset of that should be that you have to really validate the artistic experience, but it doesn't anyway mean that you should have fewer rules. It might mean you should have more rules. And it might mean you should have the most rigid rules possible, because that's what provides meaning. It's not obvious at all that even if you assume that the mitzvot don't create the feelings you're going for, but they simply channel them, that generates more flexible, more expansive rules as opposed to narrower rules. Right? Maybe halacha is
arbitrary rules.
Right? Maybe halacha is haiku that has to rhyme. Right? And because you want to have really rigid rules, and some of them are arbitrary. And
some are necessarily arbitrary.
Yeah.
That's the quote.
Yeah. I'm not sure what this. I think what Hrvatsarna's argument is that at the very least, there's the first thing that the Hakir has talked about all along, which is whether there is something outside of halacha that matters. All right, so he's taking a very strongly position that there are things that matter, and halacha is a way of channeling them, Now you could bridge the chakira and say that there are things just like there are yetzer. So the yetzer can be yetzer tov or yetzer ra. When you have lots of yetzer, it's yetzer tov. Before that, it's just neutral. You could say that also. I don't know that I would agree that it's only a slight exaggeration to say that artists are becoming the most important theologians of our day.
Yeah.
Might be more than a slight exaggeration. Might even be more than a slight exaggeration to say that it's only a slight exaggeration.
Well, it might be only a slight exaggeration, and that might be a sad statement.
Artists are probably much more influential than theologians.
I can't think of any other.
Yeah, that's
mentioning. It depends on how you define it.
You have to talk about what halacha is. So what important means in that context. Okay, so I
theology. There's no theology going around very much anymore.
Yeah, oh, that's why.
It
could be a very sad statement. Good. Artists, you know, it could be. I think it's always good to see people take strong positions that you don't intuitively agree with, and then you have to figure out, do I have to account for them or not, or do I just say, okay, that was Shigahayu Seim Piyashalit, or whatever it may be. It's just a mistake. He's a fine human being, but it's a mistake. That's what you do when you want to politely say that a particular rabbi is off his rails. I think probably to me the most powerful piece of the article is his own experience. Is his own experience as coming as a yeshiva student and meeting an artist and just not knowing, like not having any context and feeling totally overwhelmed by the intensity of a certain kind of experience. I think is really worth thinking about. And he translates that into a very strong statement. I'm not sure that, I don't agree with the statement quite as strongly as he does. But I think that the claim from experience is very powerful. Yes, John?
It was strange that he seems to switch his opinion. It's not that that's another opinion. It's, I must be missing something. There's a very, right, if he legitimately had the experience of halacha creating religious meaning, right, because he met someone to then say, I must be missing something, and I should go about the other way, right? He could have just said there are two ways, right? But he doesn't seem to, right? His response is, I'm missing my own creativity, right? Which is a very bizarre...
No, but he said he assumed that that was the case, and that's how he... It doesn't sound like he actually had that experience beforehand, but that he just sort of assumed that that's what the experience he was supposed to be having.
Right, and it's strange to assume that... Now, it may be that that didn't work for him, right, but if someone were, right, the conclusion of the article, right, he doesn't, or he assumes that the yeshiva model is not correct, as opposed to being just another model, right, which is bizarre, right? If you have the personal experience of what he thought yeshiva bachar should be like, right, then there's no reason to denigrate that experience.
Could be he thought he finally got to see in color. He'd been seeing in black and white before. Doesn't mean that somebody else can't have the opposite experience. Go through life believing that it's all about you, that it's all about the things you produce out of yourself, and all of a sudden get to halacha and say, wow, that's not what it is at all. This is what real life is. And all my time I've been engaged, I've been spending silly time destroying my toes, going like this. That's what it's about. It's about learning Gemara. Right? I'm perfectly open to the...
Jeffrey Weil?
The
non-Jew in Switzerland who found religious meaning when he found Rosenzweig here and listens and has a blog now about how he's found spirituality in Rosenzweig here and VBM.
Ah, did not know of this.
Weird.
We found out about it when he sent an email to Ari Rosenzweig asking questions here.
Wait, where is this guy?
Sweden, Switzerland, so I don't know. Jeffrey Weil.
Don't know. I have a son in Holland. I don't know. There are things. I had a I taught in Lincoln Square. I had somebody who had to leave the room in the middle because he was just feeling God talking to him. I was teaching, and I was going to put a sign up on the wall, for future say, this is a Torah study class. Conversations with God are not permitted. If you need to talk to God, please go outside. Even though I think that is what Talmud Torah is, but not quite that directly. Who knows where people will find spirituality? All right, I think
I
want.
If your class was an exercise in mental
fortitude. Very good.
Welcome home.
I wanted to give it to you. I think it's a powerful statement by somebody who does tremendous work. And so it has to be Baba Cheshbon, whether one wishes to go as far as he does or not.
What do you mean by Baba Cheshbon?
I think that when, at least I try to say that when I account for, create a vision of what ought to be, so one of the boundaries is that I should try to exclude as few people as possible who share commitments that I recognize. And I should try to grant...
What kind of vision do you think excludes
it? Oh, I have a vision which says that no, right, you know, the essence of Judaism is recognizing that, in fact, Jews are golems who are animated by halakha. Right, and the notion that they're... And the whole goal is to...
So by excluding him, you mean disagreeing?
Disagreeing forcefully. Disagreeing forcefully to the point of seeing his position as outside the bounds. But I have to recognize that my tent includes somebody who believes this strongly. As a minimum. My tent of Orthodox theology, I guess. My community.
What our Hava Mina without seeing this article has been, oh, of course we originally thought what Rabbi Sarna originally thought?
No, I don't think you would necessarily have thought that. But I don't know that if I hadn't read this, that I would not have been prepared to say, you know what, no. You know, I don't see any reason that we should take so much, that we should give so much value to artists. Or that much value to experience. I don't think that that's
well, that's neither of the things come up here. Herbert's just talking about creativity, the spirit, and inner power. That does not need to necessarily be connected to right art or artists or right. Yeah, I mean.
No, I think there are many leaps in his piece. I think it's challenging to me to have a colleague. Who says things like artists, you know, who believes it's only a slight exaggeration to say that artists are becoming the greatest theologians of our day.
Yeah, but that was just sort of a throwaway in order to illustrate his main point, which is about creativity. Truth is, this article isn't really about art at all. Or if it is, it's only incidentally because, I don't know, there was a person here who was a dancer, was it?
So that's interesting. I think that it is all about a particular type of personality that he associates with artists, and which he thinks is missing in Orthodoxy at present. And, you know, this is an argument for celebrating the artistic personality as opposed to seeing it as a danger, which he sees as the creative personality. And, you know, it seems to me like you have to read this in reaction to Isha Halakha somehow, because Isha Halakha, so the rhetoric is right out of Isha Halakha, and yet it comes to completely different goals as to where the community should be going. I don't know if he's aware of that, but it's, you know, to me, it opens up with the same celebration of creativity as Rav. Right? But then where the whole purpose of Isha Halakha is to say, and guess what, you can get all that. Right, through Talmud Torah, right here, you know, he says it's just missing. And we need the artist to give it back. Right? So I think it's a pretty strong statement that way. Yes, sir.
Assuming that everyone works that way is kind of like it's wrong. I think people tend to like bring whatever talents they have or whatever means most to them and like express themselves religiously that way. But kind of to say that, oh, now we have everyone that needs to work, kind of work within the system, and then the question is, I think, more is do you include people like all when you're running like Shiva and thinking of Halakha, do you include the people that need this, not the assumption that this is what everyone needs?
Yes, I think he's going much further and said, you know, it's an evangelical piece. Everyone needs this, and maybe not. Right? Maybe not. Maybe it's not all musical scores for everybody. Maybe there are other metaphors that work. There are better for us. Maybe there are behaviors that are meaningful repetitively, even if they are not subjectively done. And maybe we're Jews on, you know, it would be dark. Maybe we're Jews on the assembly line. Right, nobody wants you to do your creative hammer tap. Right, we want you to get the nail in the right place. That's what we want. Right? Maybe that's a workable metaphor. A workable metaphor, bricklayers. And we're just building a wall, and the goal is to build the wall in a way that efficiently allows the next person to put the brick on. And if everybody does their own creative bricklaying, then you end up with a wall that leaks. Whatever it may be. Okay. Really, I think for me, it's just useful to have him put the challenge out this strongly. I think it's probably deliberately overwritten. Perhaps, as you did suggest, he overestimates the reaction, and so he ends up looking extreme because he's trying to balance something that doesn't exist. Yes.
And not a question, it's more of a comment, I guess. It seems like we're approaching this a lot as sort of a coherent piece as an argument, but, I mean, I guess looking at the first paragraph, he's explaining how our tradition promotes and fosters the creative stuff. That's why the article says he brought in. And it seems like most of the things that he say is really just about juxtaposing positive adjectives with ideas of creativity. And I'm not saying that like, oh, he's putting them next to each other, but that he's bringing various ideas of Judaism that have various ideas of creativity, and it sort of vaguely flows together. I don't necessarily think that he's trying to make any particular argument, and if he is, I think it's very clouded. I guess that's part of the reason why I'm confused as to what we're supposed to do with it. I mean, it's more of like a feel-good piece for Jews and artists than it is like a rigorous study of any of the ideas that he explained.
No, it's not a rigorous study. And it needs to be experienced, the same way Rav Ravinder, if it's not like it needs to be experienced. Or Yeshaya. And the images in Yeshaya don't work coherently either in that sense. They don't make rigorous arguments. They are persuasive.
Who do you think this article was written for?
That's a good question for the audience. It's written to the Jewish Week. But
yeah.
And therefore?
Well, no, so I'm curious. Who do you think, Ray, he wrote this with in mind that he wanted to be reading it? Who do you think his target was?
I don't know. If you're kind of a kirov, right? His target is artists who don't feel there's a space within Orthodoxy. Right? Or it could be for Orthodox Jews who aren't sufficiently sympathetic. Those are complementary goals, because the more the community feels welcoming, the more artists are likely to consider it.
I totally assumed that it was the second one, and most of what you've been saying, I feel like, has been on the assumption that it was I totally assumed it was the first one. I think most of what you've been saying has been on the assumption that it was the second one. This was written as an impassioned plea to the Orthodox, right, to Orthodox Jewry to open up. When I read this, it reads like a piece written for non-Orthodox Jews talking about how Orthodoxy really is
interesting.
Has room and must have room for creativity. So
his background, he and Billy Berger were the co-chairs of the Orthodox Forum session on this. And so I assume that that this is sort of the companion piece to Billy Berger's piece, although Rishnara didn't actually speak about this. I don't know. Could be. I don't think he just means it as cures. That's my take. I think, based on what he said at the conference also, I don't think he means it. I think that he really sees this as a major contribution to make the community, to bring the artists in, not just for them, because the community needs them. Okay. On a very different kind of style, we have Rabbi Sperber. Rabbi Sperber has all sorts of fun categories, of which, let's say, we pick up on page 20, I believe it is. Right? So you gotta love the headline, Halakha Lu Mat Masoret. So how do you deal with a category like Halakha confronts Masoret? What does that mean? What does it mean by Masoret? Yes, Rachel.
Well, isn't it sort of like I think you said in your weekly lecture last week, something about sort of like reading the Torah as if there was no Masorah, really like seeing it as if you didn't know how it was going to end, or you didn't know what comes out of it. That was this is sort of like it's sort of like, okay, well, we have Masorah, which is sort of like the, I don't know, sort of seems to be the way Jews have traditionally behaved. And then we have the halacha, which sometimes, sort of like with minhagim, sometimes is complemented by minhag or is contrasted by minhag when it, you know, goes against halacha.
So what does he mean by masoret? Very soon. What does he mean? What tradition is he talking about?
The artistic tradition.
The artistic tradition, right? So he makes a claim. He makes a claim that there is a visual tradition in Judaism that the halakha fails to recognize. Right, that because in fact there is a rich tradition of Jewish synagogue, art that finds all the way that one can find all the way and all the way through to ancient Judaism, which does things like have Galgal Mazalot Vashemesh, and all those, right, and this is true in Ashkenaz also. So he wants to claim that archaeologically, and you know, he gives us his big picture of the Aron. Yedidia gave us the room, right? He wants to claim that archaeologically, the claim that the halakha of the Jewish people was that you weren't allowed to make any of these kinds of images is not plausible, because if you look at the history of Jews, there have always been people who did that, and did it in public, and did it in synagogue settings. And this is all pre-enlightenment, and much of it is pre-enlightenment, and it occurs in Orthodox communities, so you can't just dismiss it as saying it's sectarian. Right, you have to, right, but the archaeological evidence, his assertion is that Jews who thought of themselves from, and who were thought of by other people as from, and who perhaps even a Lichtenstein would decide, right, we decide we're Orthodox, we know. right, so people who meet, right, Jews who meet from a social perspective, all reasonable standards of Orthodoxy, had a rich tradition which involved the production of visual art, which does not seem to be constrained by at least the narrower positions of halacha, all right, as to what kinds of forms of art to produce. And in general, when you look at these things, these do not seem, if you look at the picture of the Aron on page 20, this does not seem like somebody who was animated by the bedievid notion that, well, really, I shouldn't have any decorations, but the shul insisted that I put a few on, so I'll put a few on, but of course I'm being mafri to the extent I can, because mechura davar. Right, that's not the sensibility that comes across from the Aron as, you know, an aniconic position. So, first question is, are you convinced by his claim historically, and B, do you care? All right, which one do you want to take, Jonathan?
I'll take the first one.
You'll take the first one, yeah.
I mean, I'm not convinced historically simply because, right, there were some, right, I mean, this was, if we go back to, you know, Rabbeinu Yochum and Rabbeinu Ephraim, right, you take Rabbeinu Yochum's Shuvah, right, in the original, and, right, without leaving aside his halachic claim, right, his halachic claim is trying to justify a minhag, and there were places, right, to say that all of Klal Yisrael never had, right, this was never, it's not true, right, Rabbeinu Yochum testifies to the fact that, right, the minhag until his day was not to have all that arwah, and it started at that point, right, so to claim that it was always the case is simply incorrect, unless you think Rabbeinu Yochum is lying.
Right, so probably a better description of history is that this is an old machlokas. This is an old machlokas. Okay, so now, Yedidia, would you care? Do you care about history when you, right, in terms of halacha? When it's not history,
yeah,
as recorded.
I mean, right, like we said before, I think it depends on what the history is, right?
Yeah.
If it was a history, right, if the history is a history of tension between the halacha and people who flout it, right, then I don't think it becomes less of an imperative now to try to obey the halacha, just because it used to be people, right, people who were Avar Yadami, wanted to hit a masoret of, like, of Avera, right? On the other hand, if it's an old machloket as to whether or not it's something that was acceptable or not, then right, it would appear to be a viable option to keep alive those masorot, those halachic masorot that certain things were okay.
So what happens? Let's suppose that what I know walking in, right, is that there is an old machloket in Judaism. in which there have been people who felt very strongly one way, and there are people who felt very strongly the other way. And as far back as we know from communities, both these positions have existed. Right? And that these positions are not just reflective of technical readings of texts. These are positions reflective of religious attitudes. Right? Imagine if Rashi versus Rabbeinu Tam Tfilin, right, really reflected, reflected Hasidic versus Nisnagdic approaches to Judaism, or Kabbalistic and anti-Kabbalistic approaches. Okay, well, as opposed to being whatever some machlokas that goes back a long time. We don't really know why people had it, right? So now, what's your instinct about how to approach that when the same question comes up? And you know that this is an old machloket, and there have always been strong opinions on both sides. And the question comes up again in your shul thing. Right? So what do you think is there a default way to approach questions like that? What do you think of it?
Well, as soon as you said a default way, my thoughts immediately sprang to us. I think there is a little corner. But that doesn't tend to be where my gut tends to try to build some sort of synthesis and try to arrive at some sort of position that can take into account the concerns of both sides of an issue, and try to represent something that is to whatever extent is possible is reflective of all the concerns involved. Because usually a machloka doesn't reflect one side thinking something is good in and of itself, and the other side thinking that something is bad in and of itself. Usually, right, there are two things that conflict, and some people think that one thing is more important, and another thing that something else is more important. So, I don't think it's hopeless if that's what the...
Okay. Jonathan, what do you want to say?
I'll answer it with an observation.
Uh-huh.
Right? Let's take, the Toru Mada Machlokas, right? Now, without getting to the historicity of whether it's true that the divide people make between Chachmei Ashkenaz and Chachmei Sfarad is true, right? But you will hear many, many people who will who believe in Toru Mada will say, yes, it's true the Haredi approach existed, it was Chachmei Ashkenaz, and we're following a very strong Mesorah of Chachmei Sfarad. They don't then say, or some people do, but many people you will see are very comfortable saying, that was Chachmei Ashkenaz, that was Chachmei Sfarad, we still respect for Rashi, Tosos, and whatever, but... Right, the way we think you should live is the Masorah of the Rambam and the Ramban and Ibn Ezra and whatever. Right, so I think we have other examples. Without getting into the question of whether any of these claims are correct, right, where people are very comfortable saying that it's an old machlokas, but we take a side and we think you should take that side. Right, so I see no reason why you couldn't do the exact same thing here. Right, unless you think Right, and it would be interesting, right, because, I could imagine that there would be people who would, you can pick your issues, right, but there are at least times when people are very willing to say, it's an old machlokas, right, but we feel very strongly, and therefore the other one is not as legitimate as the one, right, that I follow, and in the same breath can say we didn't lose respect for all the people who held the other minhag, we just don't think it's right, right? The Haredim will do it in the other direction, say, right, the Rambam is outvoted, right, but he's still the Rambam, right, but we can't live like that anymore, right? So, you have examples where that's the case, and I don't think it contradicts anything.
It seems to me that this machloka that we're talking about now is the people against the Rabbanim, not Rabbanim against Rabbanim. So it probably is just, I wouldn't say that we follow the, it's not like a makel approach, it's the people who didn't want to follow what the Rabbanim was.
So you think he hasn't produced enough evidence that there are rabbis, even though these things took place in shuls, but they were the shuls the rabbis couldn't control.
That's what it sounds like from the tshuva that we saw.
This is,
So then maybe the question is, if no one ever followed the halakha that we're better more setting out, is everyone sort of halakha that would be the question, not do we follow which side?
This is the mixed dancing in Orthodox shuls in the mid-20th century. Right, happened at dinners. You can see it in all the programs. But right, so it's a pragmatic mesorah. It would be wrong. It would be wrong to claim that the tradition of Orthodoxy in America banned mixed dancing. But it doesn't mean that that there was ever a real shita that it was mutter. It just means it happened. On the other hand, you know, so maybe if Rabbi Farber is right that we found the female soloist that the first time out of his dinner, so you know, if the Rav was present, so would he right at the dinner, he organized it, maybe that's different, and maybe that's a Maaser Rav. But history isn't a Maaser Rav. Right? Even the history of Frum people is not a Maaser Rav.
It's like a Lashon
Hara is mutter. Yes, right, Lashon Hara has always been mutter, right? He's always engaged in it.
So that's an interesting...
also a question of whether or not, meaning like with like Takano, if no one follows, then do they have any validity type?
But that's an interesting question, right? So we have this peculiar halacha that Rabbanans, that we gzeirish ein rov hatzibur yachol lamod bo. But right now, most people paskin metris means if it was never followed from the outset, but if you could find a 5 minutes like Geras, if you could find a 5 minute notion where people kept it, then it becomes permanently binding. And Ratz Chaya seems to suggest maybe not. But right now, very few people hold that way. Because it scares us, because does that mean that all the Rabbanans go by the wayside because none of the non-Orthodox Jews keep them? And so we're not the tension is you have to define the community as a committed. And even then, we don't, you know, it might be useful to have sunset provisions and say that if the really firm community stops keeping the Rabbanan, then it would be unwise to bring it back, which is pretty much what Maharaj Chaya suggests. You have, in American law, this is called desuetude. You have a law that's on the books, but nobody who cared about the law ever tried to follow it. Right, so then that law just vanishes, and if you try to enforce it, they declare it invalid. But other than Maharaj Chaya, I'm not sure of anyone else halachically who has ever taken that position. And that's a big part of what people call newcomers nowadays. People discovering laws that really were always on the books, but that some people never kept, or at least haven't kept for a couple hundred years, and someone brings it back and says, "Oi,
we can't recapture much of it."
Yes.
But it's on the
more clear halachos,
whether it be
Shatnez
or...
Well, the question is,
there
I said Rabbanan.
Or Chadash.
yes, Chadash is a good example. Shatnez is an interesting example. I don't know if people ever stop keeping Shatnez, they just stop checking.
So Chadash is a good example, right? Because, you know,
Chadash is a
good
example.
You have people who, without batting an eye, will say, okay, so people follow the Bach for 500 years, it's wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think you have to think about the language of Isser v'Heter. Using that, right? Whether the language you use is that's wrong or that's usher. This is one of the challenges, right? Is that the anti, for lack of a better term, Torah Mada universe is happy to declare Torah Mada usher, and the Torah Mada universe is not so happy to declare that to say that Torah only is usher, in that sense. And this is always a position of weakness. It's the you know, it is Lahavdil. It is the position that the conservatives, right? The conservative Jews follow. Find themselves in regarding egalitarianism, and it's what generates a strong temptation to right for people to declare that non-egalitarianism is usher, right? Because otherwise they feel they're at a weak, they're at a disadvantage in the conversation, right? So it would be easier for Torah Modernists to get up and say, I think that you are violating the following 15 mitzvot as you sit and learn your Gemara instead of reading Graham Greene today. It would be a stronger political position, because if you don't, then people can always say, something derives to the Chumra. Right, so that's really, I think, that's a really interesting challenge. I have to say, my tendency is not to be excessively impressed by archaeology. And I don't know, because archaeology can't give me a context. Right, if you were to show me that really, we know that in every shul, that every Rav davened in the 17th, 18th centuries, they were all sorts of pictures. And you don't find any letters by Rabbanim denouncing this practice. That would be one thing. But I'm not sure at this stage that we're just discovering that, you know what, rabbis always fight losing battles. And in America in the 1940s and 50s, they're losing battles against mixed dancing. And in Europe in the 1860s, 1870s, losing battles against decorated shuls. And the rabbis may have said to themselves, well, you know, maybe they thought it was usher because it was a ruach, because it would distract them from kavanah. But then they could always fall back and say, we don't have kavanah nowadays anyway, so what's the big deal? Right? There are all sorts of halachas that are built on the premise that kavanah is impossible. We don't hold that consistently, because we make you go back if you forgot Shemoneh Esrei. Which really, since we hold there's no kavanah nowadays, we should say it's the bracha levatoa. We don't let you go back the second time because of that. Right? So we're not perfectly consistent about that. But we do have that. Okay, so that I think is a question you have to take into account. Rabbi Sperber obviously takes archaeological evidence with great significance,
And I'm not sure that that I agree with him. It's a big issue because for a lot of people, the discovery, let's say that Dura Europa, so they had a shul. Okay, they had a shul. So what? Doesn't I think you have to figure out which one.
Dura Europa.
Europa is the big shul they uncovered with the oldest shul they uncovered with murals.
Oh, I thought that was Beit Hafra.
No, isn't it? Isn't it Europa? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
I think so. There's a whole exhibit in Philadelphia this year of art based on it. It has biblical scenes, there's all sorts of things, but so what?
It has God.
Yeah. So I think it's a really interesting question, and among these are the questions whether you're comfortable adopting a position which says that the Gavra did something usur, but it doesn't mean that he was an avaria. Right? The claim that if until the halacha is mivurar, that people used to behave in a way which turned out eventually to be usur, doesn't mean that they don't go to heaven. Right, is that a comfortable position? Do you assume if it's wrong, it's wrong? Always was wrong. Yes, Yehuda.
How can we say otherwise? You say either Beit Hillel or Beit Sharmai did not have Olam Haba?
So you can distinguish between a class of halachot which could have gone either way, and eventually the halacha was determined this way, but prior to that there was no halacha, and cases where, right, that's where you think, you know what? I don't care which way. It turned out this way. Great. And other halachas where you think there's a right and a wrong, it's just we didn't figure out which was right and which was wrong until later. You can say that, but that doesn't work, right? That doesn't. Rav Lichtenstein's mind is he's not really willing to believe that Rabbeinu Tam was never Mekayin Tfilin D'Yalom. Right? Even if it turns out Rashi was right and Rabbeinu Tam was wrong, he just can't say Rabbeinu Tam didn't fulfill the mitzvah Tfilin. He's not willing to say that. And I think the only way to explain that is that the halacha didn't exist yet. But over time, it turned out the halacha turned out this way. But other halachas, which you might think, let's say, I think if we hadn't yet clarified that you're not supposed to do certain things that are evil to other people, so then it was wrong to do it the first time. Now, the fact that we didn't know the halacha yet doesn't change the fact that it was really evil or really good. Okay, so then Chavei Sperber makes a whole set of other types of claims. So you have the specific, as I said, we'd see somebody who makes the specific claim that, but it's again built in archaeology, that if you look on page 22, I believe it is, it's early now, when he talks about the nude and the naked.
Yeah, I
do. Right. 20. On top of the 20, he says, right, so let's actually start on the bottom of page 19. And read it through. What he says is, Leitim hatashtita basisit lipsakim ela muta'it. Bekovet haniskar, mustamecha mechaber al divrei harav binyamin Yehoshua Zilber, hamasbir ki chazal lo danu besugiyat tmunot eirun mipnei shlo hayamatsui lahem. Right, so you think, so some people think chazal didn't address unclothed pictures because in the time of chazal there were no unclothed pictures. Zukamavan ta'ut tanovat mi burut biyachas olam ha-reali shel chazal. Right, this is just, people don't understand what's going on in chazal. Zure rum nochach amanut tehellenistit shol tkufat chazal, v'af nimsa bevatei hakneset ha'atikim. Eirum nochach gam hagadot shol pesach b'magzirot niyar. I'm not sure what the magzirot niyar means. Al chevtei yudaika uv'sha'arei sfarim hilchatiim. Al'chana zu madgima t'achreach sh'rabanim et yamrim l'sok b'yanei amanut yilmadu et toldoteha v'yakiru et machoneha. Okay, so the... Right, so the first thing is, this Tanya Rejachter is his claim that if you want to talk about art, you have to know art history. If you want to paskin art, you have to know what people really did. So the claim that Chazal didn't address this because they didn't know about it is simply implausible if you know anything about the Hellenistic world. Right, it's full of nude art. So for example, he says, Tovnot merkaziot b'siach amanut adayin lo hishtalvu b'siach hilchati. וראוי שההלכה העכשווית תיתן את דעתה עליהן. כזו היא למשל ההבחנה בין סוגי עירום שונים, הנוד והנקד. ההבחנה בין עירום כקונבנציה אמנותית אסתטית, ובין עירומו של מי שהופשט מבגדיו ונותר עירום, הזינה את השיח היהודי בעבר, אך טרם קיבלה את ביטויה בשיח ההלכתי הכתוב. Right? So he wants to make the assertion that we do have at least some instances of nudes in ancient synagogues and or in illustrated Haggadot and things like that, which seems to suggest that there was a time when you could describe, but he says, the nude as an aesthetic convention, as opposed to the naked, which here he's going to take as erotic, although we have also we've seen that there's also a category in modern art of the naked non-erotic, the naked deliberately non-erotic, where in fact the purpose of taking off clothes is dafka to show people as non-erotic capacity. So how do you? But his fundamental argument is that there are elements of the artistic conversation which halakha is lacking, and because it doesn't recognize these conceptions, and it's the only category you have to address art, to address the art of the human body, is tefach b'isha erva, and the like. Then you're simply not relating to the art, right? To the art the way it is. The artists don't paint. Artists don't paint certain kinds of things with the intent of creating erotic pictures. And so there's right. So the whole conversation is impoverished.
I'm pretty different than any question of, let's say, tefach b'isha erva outside of art.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have a naked person who's not naked for erotic purposes. I mean.
Right.
I guess I'm not seeing why the fact that now that we're talking about art, and art has certain interesting prelukim, for example, the nude and the naked, means that has to be in halakhic literature. And I guess where that assertion came from and why does he think that it's true and with such force, when it seems like he just sort of made it up, this should have a lot of significance.
Okay, that's a fair question. Right? He assumes yes, and you're assuming no. Right, that's a fair...
And not only am I assuming no, I'm not sure where he gets it from, and especially, I mean, the Tevach B'Yish Erva point, I mean, it's clear that our society has certain ideas of what's erotic and what's not, and it's clear that the halakha doesn't care about that, and I don't see why art should be any different if we're using the exact same halakhos.
Maybe he would think it should be different if you could actually pull it off. If you could create, he might think the same thing about certain kinds of dance. If you could find a, find non-erotic context, right? Non-erotic context for right, which you.
But if you could find a non-erotic context for a person being naked, would that be okay?
He might think so. He might think so. Not perhaps for saying Kriyat Shema opposite, which isn't the Shashirher. Right, but in terms of right, but he might think that but he might think that for halachas which are only about hirhur, and that would be enough.
Okay.
Right? Maybe you can learn Torah at a nude beach, if you think that's what it is.
I think you'd have to say that.
Okay. Yeah, I think he might have to say that. He might be.
I think he would say that it's more according to the language of the halacha to have a real naked human being, so being more machmir, but it...
He could be skeptical of whether people actually do that or not, and not skeptical of artists. It's also possible. You know, I could believe that human beings are incapable of doing that live, but as artists are capable of representing the human body solely as form, without erotic interest.
I mean, I don't know. We sort of had this discussion already. Someone mentioned a few classes ago about Basar v'Chalav, and how we don't try to inject cooking categories into halakha. I mean, it just whatever.
Okay, so you don't find it compelling at all. That's fine. Yes, you do.
The problem we had in Chavruta with the general attitude is that he says halakha says this, and I think by current artistic standards that's ridiculous. Therefore, halakha must change. The conclusion we had a lot of trouble with. Maybe halakha is right, and your current artistic standards are wrong. Why are you
could be
assuming that? That's
could
an
be
assumption that bothered me. He didn't even like discuss it. Just assume.
Yeah.
He felt it was self-evident. Once I say that, halakha obviously.
Well, what he thinks is that you have to that halakha has that bali halakha has to at least understand the artistic conversation before they can make judgments. I think his assertion is that the halacha currently is incapable of addressing these distinctions. He might be okay with somebody who says, I've read it, I understood it, and you know what? Nonetheless, it's usur. But until you understand the distinctions, he thinks that you're talking about something you don't know anything about. You know, that you're making blanket bans for lack of, you're like banning, you're banning biology because you think that all biology is about is the origin of species. Now, maybe at the end you'll think all biology is usur. Might be able to be convinced the origin of species is mutur. But meanwhile, you just don't know anything. Right? That's his claim. I don't know if that's true.
Like, what does he want from us? Maybe it's better you don't know current art, because if you go 20 years ago, art 20 years ago is very, very different than art today. So maybe it's a good thing that we don't know current art and tie halacha to that.
Maybe. Maybe we should tie halacha to the upstate New York, whatever, the New York Hudson Valley School. Okay, halacha should only encourage blue paintings with buffalo. Blue paintings with brown buffalo. Or, radical moments where you have brown paintings with blue buffalo. Paul Bunyan.
That's an ox.
Yes, I know, thank you.
he does say that, right? The idea of halachic decision needing to gain knowledge, he talks about when he talks about the historical reality thing. There he says he needs to be educated, but here he does seem to be saying that not only do you need to have knowledge, but your halachic decision making needs to reflect these differences, because these distinctions are significant, right? They are objectively significant whether you like it or not. And you must recognize them, because if you don't, you are stuck in the past. Those are the words he uses. And that seems to be just a conception of, right, of progress that is making a lot of assumptions that people might not necessarily get by.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Kind of like, a horror that I had. That is, I agree with everything they're saying. Like, I was thrown, if you just read his Hakdama, where he's talking about the different, volumes that they put out. You read this part of that?
Yeah.
Right? And the name of the second volume. Right, El Ela Elohecha Yisrael, right, which is representations of God, right? Like, there doesn't seem to be any attempt to, right, to be, you don't write something that's clearly, right, the pasuk is clearly Avodah Zarah oriented, right? It's the attitude, it comes out in everything. It's not, it's very flippant, right? Even if you want to make a point about something being, right, sacred, so don't then, right, and you think that you're not being, you're not going against the halachic system, so don't start naming things in such a way that it represents that. It just reflects an attitude, which is just disturbing.
There's all the women's crawler groups that are called Kolisha.
Yes.
Even
I
the ones...
Some of them, it's actually so that you know if you want to listen to their song, so it's Kolisha.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
It's not, but that's very true.
Yes.
Before I knew that such things existed, I thought that would make a lot of sense.
Ah.
So, therefore, I assume that once I found out
that
things existed,
there was a group that are called Yish.
There was an art installation at the Yale Hillel that was a bunch of statues, and the title was Graven Imaginings. Was the name of the
Oh my gosh.
Was the name of the thing.
It's hard to make arguments that you're within the spirit of halacha when you're doing when you're just trying to snub halacha. It's really what it seems like. You read it, right? It's people who are grappling with how to make icons of God, right? Which they call Elo Elohecha Yisrael. Right? How do you take the halacha seriously?
I don't think that's supposed to be halacha. It's not a halachic institution that he's buying.
But he's trying to make halachic argument this is good, or that halacha should...
Some of it. Halacha should at least take into account. I don't know if he thinks that everything has to be mutter. Halacha has to take it into account. What about his critique of Rav Sherlo? And what do you have any, what does he not like about Rav Sherlo? Or, he gives Rav Sherlo a...
8 out of 10 or something.
Yeah. Progress. He gives Rav Sherlo progress. Right, that... It doesn't get us where we need to go, but that kind of language and that kind of conversation is very useful to getting where we need to go. And so what's good about Rosh Hashanah, we understand, is Rosh Hashanah celebrates the artistic impulse as an essential element of human existence. And Asherlo is, you know, taken as, you know, part of the group, I believe, has the nationalistic impulse. Right, that we need to have a vibrant artistic culture. Why isn't it far? Why doesn't it go far enough?
Where is
the article now? Page 22, right? Ben Gavol and Amoch, uven Hamanut Lachayim. Right. So Rabbi Tagashua, right, disagree on the ancient distinction, both cultural and rabbinic, between high and low culture, and between art and life. Right. And mechavnim levitul hapar ben olam haTorah shel olpanot veYeshivot uven haChayim haModerniim. Internet, musica, v'chule. Right. So they're seeking to nullify. The chasm between the world of Torah as expressed in Torah educational institutions and modern life, specifically internet and music and things like that. Rabbanim Eilam Evinim Yitzirat Amanut Kavodat Takel Uchumakom Shebo Mitrachashim Talichim Alukim Shalachayim Hametach Hamasorati Shebein Amanim LaRabbanim Muchlafkan B'Siach Hadadim Mafre. Right. So this is all great. Right. They recognize that the artistic impulse is an essential part of life. And they create an open conversation between artists and rabbis, right? Even a conversation perhaps in which each are vulnerable to each other, right? Berger suggests. So shituf pu'ulam afrek hazeh omed v'vasis tochnit beit ha-midrash ha-vizuali shemitatei ha-otzer ha-yotzer ha-yudi levi aldam, I don't know, l'ftach muzion al-shem vulfin v'echal shalom v'yerushalayim. Okay, so this is a space where, Berger is the space where religion and art will meet. Right, this is all very good, right, so we've gone to page 23. So why is this not enough? Right, the last paragraph is still great. The last paragraph on the first page of page 23 says, Hatvisa shel beit sefer hi she'amanut v'yitzira einan rak kishut o isokim she'amataratam milui hazman ha'panui. Ela kelim ruim levitui pnimiut hanefesh. Right, so you have to understand that art is not just decoration, and not just a way of filling your time more productively than would otherwise be bitul zman. Right, but really art is a way of expressing, right? Art is a way of expressing critical internal spiritual urges. Why is it not enough?
He says somewhere, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
That was what is enough.
Yeah.
Before that wasn't enough.
Okay. So what's lacking before?
Right. On page 22, the first paragraph after the break is in Gisha Zoshal Rabbanim Nisayar Ki Di'ar Romantit Merateket Me'anyene Ulam Chasira Bigla Hanisayon Litzor Mitoch Matok Ve'akum Tarbuti She'eino Mitasher L'Toldot Ha'omanut
Matok Vakum. Ve'akum, isn't it Mitoch Vakum?
Oh, vacuum! Mitor mitoch vacuum. I was like, what is this bracket? Mitor mitoch vacuum tarbuti, sheino mitashel todot ha'omanut.
Okay, good, right. So the flaw is that the flaw...
They're trying to create something out of nothing.
The flaw of Rabbi Ariel's approach,
right,
is that it rejects the history of art.
Right.
It wants Jewish art to appear out of nothing. That's an interesting question, right? You know, if you want to claim that you can be an artist, but in order to be an artist, right, you can't be Asher Lev.
Right. You have to reject Tavruta
Rebbe. You have to reject everything. You have to reject the past. That's a sort of extreme position. Because, you can only transform the past.
Well, yes and no, because, I mean, we put some store in Judaism, we put some store in the genetic fallacy.
Yeah.
Like what comes out of evil is contaminated. And, right, you could say that, right, if you hold as sacred the Western artistic tradition, not just, you can look at it, no, but if you hold yourself, you say, we must be, there's some value, internal inherent value in being part of a specific artistic culture, right, that the Vodas are. Because what is the inherent value in that? Right? It would be just the same as saying, we must base ourselves on, the Japanese school of whatever it is, art, in the 18th century. That must be the basis for everything that moves forward. Like, why this?
Yes, right.
So it seems right, when Rav Ariel says, if we wanted to do art, right, we want to at least make it sort of culturally Jewish and start from Jewish sources and almost out of nowhere, that has an appeal for me.
Okay. Yeah, he would think that that's not art, right? Because art only makes sense against the context of tradition. And that's like telling us to write Torah in Esperanto. Maybe not.
Well, if Judaism really has no artistic tradition in and of itself, then that's tough.
All right. Well, he thinks not, right? He thinks we should reclaim all the synagogue art.
Okay, fine. But then in that case, we should be basing on the synagogue art, not on the nude and the naked.
All right. So what did you think of the synagogue art? He thinks it's built on that, because synagogue art said
he doesn't think that synagogue art takes into account the nude and the naked.
He thinks that art in Haggadah does.
Even that, he doesn't seem like, he says that they had right, nude people in it, but I don't think he thinks that they had a distinction between the nude.
You think that's hell, of course they would have had naked people. Everyone knows that stuff there. So if they have unclothed people, they must believe that they're nude.
So you could make that argument, but I think it would probably be a tendency.
Uh-huh. So what did you think of the Gavra Chefza t-shirts and the way he understood them? Did you get the page of the Gavra Chefza t-shirts? Yeah. Here we are. There are t-shirts. One of them says Gavra, and one of them says Chevra. And he has a really interesting interpretation of them. He says, the question is, Haim ha'isur al levishat ha'chutot ha'munfasot ha'isur shel Gavra, kelomer isur ha'adam levishotam, ha'isur shel Chefza, kelomer shel ha'chutat zma. With an Akhmina being, right, any time l'shtamesh b'chutal ha'nikuy ha'vat b'et midrash b'lul b'oshotam. That's all sure that's what it's about. I'm not at all sure what it's about. But that's what the Gavra Chefza t-shirt is about. I don't know what the issue of wearing the t-shirt is. That is the premise. I would think much more it's a meditation that every human being is both a Gavra and a Chefza, and it's really talking about Sart or something like that. But who knows? Okay, I want to set out my own thesis about this, which you can buy or not buy. But here again, the challenge is whether I'm legislating my own sensibility. It's not clear where any of the celebrations of art allow for positions that don't make the world of Torah as it is look good.
Look good.
Look good, right? How do? And this may be a. In other words, let's say for example the satire. So we have in Chazal, Kol Tenusa Red Asura Chutzin Tenusa Avodah Zara. We ban all Leitanus except for Leitanus of Avodah Zara, and Leitanus of Avodah Zara. Right? The Gemara goes on for a while making vulgar jokes about the names of the ancient gods. Right, the whole list of ways in which you can turn the names of Greek gods into vulgarities. I have to say, this is not a form of Leitanus that appeals to me greatly. But then you have Purim. Now Purim is, for many people, an example of an underground, so to speak, tradition, right, where There's all, you know, as far back as we know, there have been Purim jokes, and as far back as we know, there have been rabbis who have been wondering why Purim jokes are permitted. And then there are people who try and make rules as to what kind of Purim jokes, what kind of Purim jokes is permitted. And you have all sorts of interesting stories about what really did happen and didn't happen in the legends of the Purim jokes. But the legend had this minute ago, apparently it's going to tell us of picking one of the Talmidim and making him the Purim Rosh Hashanah.
Really?
Yeah.
Like in The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
I haven't seen The Hunchback of Notre Dame, or read.
Like the Feast of Fools, and like you have like a king who's like a fool.
King for a day. Well, there's in many cultures, right? I didn't know it was The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Right? So
I don't know if it's in the real one, it's in the Disney one.
Uh-huh. So the legend, according to a number of reports, actually had such a tradition. You know, there some people deny it, but there seemed to be a number of eyewitness reports, and which was regarded with ambivalence by some members of the staff and supported by others. Jonathan knows. I remember that, you know, something made a deep impression on me at NYU was when Rav Moshe was Nister just before Purim, and the question was whether to cancel the spiel or not. And Rav Moshe decided the spiel was too important. The life of Yeshiva, you have to have a spiel. Now, what's Matir spiel? A spiel is a way of making fun, you know, making fun of people. What's Matir? I have my own influence about this. I say, you know, that I wrote Purim Vasser things, and some of them were quite sharp, and at some point I decided that I just couldn't justify it anymore. This year, for the first time, probably in 20 years, I wrote a Purim piece because we were trying to figure out again how to teach the students to do a clean, serious Purim spiel, and that required doing satire. So I wrote a satire. And I'm not sure it was good for my neshama. It was a lot of fun. And the students in the end decided it was too sophisticated that they wouldn't. All the students who read it loved it, but they didn't think any of their friends would understand it. But so there we have a similar thing. Like, why is this justified? Why is making fun of things in a way that shows up the negative side? Right? Why would it ever be permitted? And it's not clear. But I can frame it as...
I don't understand, but why would it be forbidden?
Because it's lacking for a rabbi, because some of the people are making fun of our rabbis. It certainly runs the risk of embarrassing people in public. There are lines that everyone will remember that will make people never be able to see certain things quite as seriously again. You really have, right? They're really good lines. The best ones are double-edged. You know, and make fun of things both ways. I was very impressed with the concept of this year's spiel, with the, you know, the way you guys going to 770 to try and teach Chabad guys to read, you know, to read Hawking Man. Hey, that was very funny. You know, it was a good double-edged line to this. Both made fun of the Chabad Enterprise and of the YU Enterprise for being unable to be the Chabad Enterprise. And that's the kind of satire that I most appreciate, you know, which cuts both ways. But why is it mutter? It makes fun of lots of people who are trying to engage in the Torah Enterprise. It makes the whole episode, the whole Kira of Enterprise look ridiculous. So why is it mutter? Now I'm committed to thinking that it's mutter. And not just because I find it funny. There was a time when I might have been committed to making it mutter because I found it funny. But the truth is that I still like it, but I don't tend to do that anymore. I thought it was bad for me. And let's say, a month or two ago, I was reading some of memoirs. But also kind of thought of often serious things. But I quoted to Deborah a couple of, you know, but he really, really, really disliked the people he worked with. And he had these vicious score settling lines in there, which were very likely entirely justified. And at one point I quoted a couple of them to Deborah, and she looked at them and she said, "Why are you reading that book? You don't read books like that. You know, you're not supposed to enjoy things like that." And she was right. So I put it down. No, it was an atavistic impulse to like score settling memoirs, even though it was very, very funny. And I had no personal interest in the largely Roman Catholic prelates who were being cured.
So I think I'm capable now of saying that if I think this really ought to be mutter, it's not because, A, I have a compelling need to express myself artistically through the medium of satire, because I really did stop writing poem pieces, and I really hadn't written a poem piece in 20 years, and I don't feel better about myself for having written one this year. It's nice to know, apparently, I can still do it. I also don't think that I pretend that people don't get hurt. Because people do get hurt by Firmspiel. Sometimes they get hurt. The only time I've ever been hurt by a Firmspiel was when I got left out. It was really kind of a dig at YU when they put the editor of commentator in, okay? They put the editor of some IBC journal in Hebrew with it. Who read? Because it had some vicious insult against the looks of the Luminous Stern. He got a permanent thing. The editor of Avatar didn't rate attention. That was really... that was really a bad sign. It was friends of mine writing this spiel. I was very insulted. But I know that I was lucky that, you know, either I didn't get the jokes. At Harvard Hill, my first year, they sang me the Rubber Ducky song. I didn't know it was a Rubber Ducky song, so I thought it was just a straight love song. And that was very sweet that at the perm spiel they sang me a love song. you're right. Rabbi Klasser, you're the one. and I was fine, you know. The first spiel of Maimonides involved a large group of students wearing velvet kippot, which I wore then, and just walking across stage, looking lost and bumping into each other. With a voiceover saying, "Wandering Clappers, what are you?" It was very funny. It was really very funny. In fact, I did spend some time wandering the hall bumping into people. More philosophically minded back then. I've been very blessed in the perm reference to me, on the whole. But I don't think that's why, the spiel was important or mutter. It was because it was the only time that students got to be honest. And I think that the spiel is best, that's what it does. It's, you know, it's like Samizdat in the Soviet Union. It lets you express things you can't express the rest of the year. And it gives you sort of an out. Now, it may be that kind of satire is really only necessary in a totalitarian culture, or in an authoritarian culture. It gives you an opportunity to. You all know the difference between a totalitarian and authoritarian government?
I've never heard authoritarian.
In the 1980s, the United States was strongly supportive of the government of El Salvador, which was a dictatorship of some sort, and it was strongly opposed to the government of Nicaragua because it was a dictatorship. And Jean Kirkpatrick was asked to explain, who was Secretary of State then, was asked to explain why we supported the government of El Salvador and opposed the government of Nicaragua, at a time when it was not appropriate to give the Lyndon Johnson answer, which was essentially, we don't care. Right? I won't quote Johnson's line originally, but basically, Johnson's line was, you know, yes, they're both evil people, but these are our evil people. So Jane Kirkpatrick was not, right, it was a moralistic foreign policy, so you could not say that. So Jane Kirkpatrick explained that the government in Nicaragua was a totalitarian country, whereas the government of El Salvador was an authoritarian country. Now, we have to know his background is that the governor of Nicaragua actually, you know, did all these cruel things, whereas the governor of El Salvador, the same people, would then go out privately and do the evil things. They were called right-wing death squads, which were not officially government-sanctioned. So Dan Wasserman, the cartoonist, put up Ed Jane Kirkpatrick explaining the difference between an authoritarian and a totalitarian regime is that in a totalitarian regime, the government kills, oppresses, and otherwise tortures, and otherwise harasses its citizens, whereas in an authoritarian regime leaves many of these functions to the private sector. right, which pointed out the real issue, which of course was communism versus capitalism, but framed it in this one. This is a brilliant line, right? The difference, because that was a difference in Nicaragua and El Salvador. That El Salvador, right, it was like all these functions the government hired people to do, as opposed to directly employing them. I think that kind of satire is most necessary in a culture where people don't feel they can say what they want, what can't ordinarily say what they really believe. But even in the United States, right? So Wasserman has perfect freedom of speech, and yet he made that point much more powerfully than anybody else would. Right? To me, that just summed up in a nutshell. This is what we are doing in foreign policy. You might decide it's okay anyway, but you could never, right? But it just blew away the whole pretense that there was an intrinsic difference between the Nicaraguan and the Salvadoran government. And I have to say, I thought it was the right policy, but it blew away any moral pretense, which I think was valuable to understand that there was nothing moral whatsoever going on in what we were doing, other than protecting ourselves, which is also a moral endeavor. But what I want to suggest is that it's not really possible to build a serious art which thematically will only make points that the rabbis agree with. The attempt to confine art technically is not hard or impossible or even terribly challenging to artists, I suspect. But whatever rules you make, part of the art will be exposing the arbitrariness or silliness of those rules. Right? If you make a rule about, if you make a rule banning kolisha, so you will have women's groups named kolisha even if they obey all the rules you have. Right? You will have, right? You will have.
If you have a rule, you can't try to expose.
Yeah. So that one's not going to work. And it's always very hard to figure out how you're going to deal with it, because it'll either happen directly because art plays with forms, so you'll have direct attacks, direct satire in that way. Let's say, for example, the best parallel to this is the Gemara of Rabbi Yirmiyah. Right, Rabbi Yirmiyah gets thrown out of the Beit Midrash. Why? Because they're trying to draw an arbitrary line about how, right, if you find doves in the wilderness, can you keep them or do you have to return them? So they set an arbitrary line, 50 paces away from a dovecote. It's yours, less than 50 paces, you have to return it. Okay? Right, all this rule. It has to be a rule somehow, right? So if everybody gets up and says, what if the dove has 1 foot on this side of the line and 1 foot on that side of the line? So they throw them out. Right? They throw them out because they can't tolerate, they can't, right? So he's missing the point. Of course, everyone knows the line is arbitrary. Who cares? There are other times when Rabbi Yirmiyah asks questions that are really important of exactly the same variety. Because sometimes asking that question shows that the rule is useless. Because in every case you can find, like, for example, I think, in the Gemara of Matia, the Gemara Rabbi Yitzchak gives a rule, what's considered scattered? Two up, right? Kavadal Damos. So Rabbi Yirmiyah asks a series of questions, right? What happens if the object is bigger? What if the object is smaller? What happens if the object is more expensive? What happens if the object is less expensive? What happens if you have the same ratio in a bigger, right, more things in a bigger space, but in the same ratio, fewer things in a smaller space? At the end of it, what Rabbi Yirmiyah has established is, do you know what case the rule of Kav Adal Amos is useful for? If you have exactly a Kav of exactly this material in exactly Dal Amos, then we know what the halacha is. But there is no other case in which we know the halacha. Right? So he effectively, right, his questions effectively point out the rule is arbitrary, but the rule is useless. Right, that's really valuable. But pointing out the rule is arbitrary, duh. Okay, we all know. You set the line somewhere, guess what? It doesn't take a genius to figure out that if you set a line, right, that there's going to be the possibility of an object that is on both sides of the line, and we have to figure out what we do. And you'll say, it depends on which side of the line is most on. Good, but there's going to be the possibility of an object that is exactly equipoised on the line. So you know what? We'll say, yes, loco, and go home, right? What's the point of that question? But the point of that question is to make fun of arbitrariness. And for that, they throw him out of the Medrash, I think. But I don't think you can have rules that will not generate a satirical response that way, that makes fun of the rule at its edge. And I think that any art that is realistic is going to show flaws. Right, any art that is interested in truth as opposed to propaganda is going to show flaws. Like the film we saw the Rich Actor. Right, it's going to, right, if you show what Orthodox married life is, it's going to have elements that somebody could find grounds for Isserim, right? It diminishes Kvod HaTorah. Look, right, it made rabbis on the Beit Din figures of fun. Right, it diminishes belief that Taras HaMishpacha leads to a happy marriage, because look, here are people who probably keep Taras HaMishpacha, and they don't seem to have a happy marriage. In fact, they don't seem to have, of course I could presume they didn't keep Taras HaMishpacha. If I just thought there'd never been a consultation, I could say, look, this is a film about the lack of, if they kept Taras HaMishpacha, they would have developed a relationship that was non-physical, and that's where none of this would have happened. I could assume that. I doubt that's what this film is really about. So I think, I want to set it out as a thesis, that non-decorative art, I think, is not, and here again, that decorative art, I am fundamentally willing to say that artists can create beauty within almost any kind of rules, as long as you just don't just ban the creation of beauty. There will always be a way to create beauty, even if the only way you can create beauty is in abstractions that are black and white. You can still create beauty. So it doesn't. Right, so there are no boundaries that matter to me in terms of decorative art that way, because you know what? There will always be beauty. There won't be that particular kind of beauty in the world. All right. If we want to ban triangles and only allow squares, so we won't have triangular beautiful art. There are certain types of beauty that are only attainable in triangles. All right. The world is not deeply impoverished to me. I would be perfectly fine with the halacha if halacha just arbitrarily picked 16 shapes to asr, because we needed to make the point that some things have to be asr. But art that is not about, this goes back to Chava's point, art that is not about beauty, but is rather about truth. Even if sometimes those categories merge, right? Sometimes beauty is a vehicle for expressing truth, or sometimes the truth you want to express is the capacity for beauty. I think that kind of art is much harder to set is much harder to bound by rules. Especially rules that are content-based, that are outcome-based, as opposed to form-based. Right. So I think that. Right. So I think it's hard to talk about what marriage is like or what life is like in any way without introducing an erotic component. As much of life is about erotic, is about the erotic and how you handle the erotic. And I think it's tough to talk about halachic life without, in honest ways, without exposing the reality that for many people it's empty. And it just doesn't work for many people much of the time. Any honest picture of Orthodox life, right? I don't know if Shulgim does this or not, is going to show people. It's going to show people mumbling through the words at high speed, and things like that. And that's always going to be very hard to justify halachically, because there will always be outcome categories that make it possible to make it up there. So that to me, and then the only way you can justify, let's say, what's the justification for art that makes fun of the rabbinic establishment? Even if it makes very mild fun of the rabbinic establishment, the way that film did. It's very mild fun. It doesn't, it's not like Mikudeshet, the propaganda film about Agunot, which really makes the rabbis come across as evil. It just makes the rabbis come across as slightly comic figures who care only about who care only about details and don't have any sense of the human aspect of what they're accomplishing. And I think like Tachadrilin Komeif, that was a great moment. Right? Yeah, go back to your place. Go back to your place. That was the one moment where the filmmaker got a little bit out of control. I think. And this wasn't even a film that emphasized, you know, the maleness of the environment, which is a real issue in Gittin. That it's all a group of men, right? It's a group of men, right? You can have as many as, even without spectators, you can have three dayanim on the Beit Din, and a sofer, and a shliach, and two eidim, and a husband. Right? So it's eight men and one woman in a room. And the husband has the power to say no at the last minute. And he can do this over and over again if she wants her get, because nobody can force, right? Because you can't force him to give the get. So he can make the woman come back every day for 40 days and say, maybe tomorrow. Right, that's very. And the film didn't do that either. But an honest film about the Orthodox divorce process would show that. And there would be lots of grounds for saying, what is the heter for something that makes halacha look bad? That makes the rabbis look bad. Very likely, if you talked about what the characters are thinking while this happens, you would discover that they're thinking all sorts of other things. Right? So if you have any kind of depiction of their imagination or even their language, right? People will say vulgar things in times like that. And the experience of the film will be different. And it'll be different whether you experience it as, you need to think about how halacha deals with characters who are just vulgar all the time, but are frum. And you have to deal with, and some powerful films are built around characters who would never say anything like that the rest of the time, but this drives them so crazy they say things that they, right? Not to mention, they have a avodah zarah, they might have idolatrous yearnings too, who knows, or at least yearnings towards kfirah. So, it seems to me that an underlying question, and this goes back to the conversation about whether art has an independent value. So I think there's art as an independent value is one type of claim. And the second is whether art is a particular way of expressing things honestly in the community that we think there should be space to hear. Even though we might not be so into that if people just said them boldly. Partially because they're always balanced, because the difference between that film and a screed, right, is that it doesn't actually tell you anything you don't know. It just makes you look at things that you otherwise could overlook. And so that to me is now, you could argue there's nothing intrinsic to art about this. It's just that mode of communication. There's certainly nothing intrinsic about visual art, because you can do it in movies, you can do it in print, and I certainly don't have any overwhelming urge to express things visually, as opposed to expressing things in writing. Once in a while, it's great, and it's great when something, there are sight gags you can't do visually. One of my favorite sight gags is a cartoon of a guy carrying you have this field of columns, right, stone columns, and there's a guy who has one of the columns on his back and is carrying it, and the really heavy stone column, the caption on it is, I hate daylight savings time. You're in Stonehenge, right? And Stonehenge is set up, right, to arrange so that at certain times of day the sun... Anyway, it's really kind of funny if you see it. So, these are the illustrations for students to realize how embedded they are in culture, because all my students again recognize immediately when I show them the picture that it's Stonehenge, and they know immediately that Stonehenge has something to do with the calendar, but they also know that it's funny, right? Because they always say that time shouldn't affect it, because Stonehenge is about astronomy, not about times of day, right? And it's about calendar, not about clock, right? So they have to know all those things in order to get the joke, and right, when I tell them a Jewish joke, they don't get it at all, right? So the way of pounding home to them, like which culture they really live in. If that cartoon.
I mean, like, what kind of Jewish joke don't they get?
I mean, they get cultural Jewish jokes.
Most people,
because I've done it
done experiments like that, you can create a Jewish joke and a non-Jewish joke in which your audience will get the not-Jewish joke and the Jewish joke. It's not very hard.
The usual counter joke I tell them is, right, there's a guy in Yeshiva who starts getting letters that are perfume. Call again. And every day, they'll call and every day have perfumed letters. Eventually...
What does the letter say?
Don't know. Address. Written in a feminine hand. And eventually, she just can't tolerate it. Every day, everybody gets the letters from home. And he gets this. So they call him in. But I've seen open letters. And they look and they say, they're love letters. But I'm the woman who's not his wife. So the Shashiva calls him in and says, Yanko, what's going on here? And he says, what do you mean, Rebbe? I intend to marry her. And he says, what? But you're already married. And he says, well, if Rosh Hashiva can violate the Chayim Rebbe Gershon, so could I. Right, you have to know that there's a Chayim Rebbe Gershon against opening mail, and a Chayim Rebbe Gershon against polygamy.
That's
right.
A really intricate halakha.
Yeah, so it is.
That's
like Stonehenge.
Are.
Like Stonehenge.
Yeah, I like
Stonehenge.
Your version, I think, is better.
All right, I think it's Stonehenge. You know, I think that's a moral equivalent. You have to know a lot of stuff to get this stuff.
It's not
different
people
do
different things.
I told it badly, okay. Number 17. See, but that you get, right? This is a humor tradition, right? I can just say,
no,
you missed it, sorry.
I mean, I don't get that.
I must have told it badly also. That was a triple reflection joke.
I'll tell you
after. The question I would frame as, do we wish to privilege certain kinds of truth-telling? Right, do we have a bias? Right,
what
is
something true?
Well, we don't know if it's truth or not, right? Because if we could, right,
if
we could control it.
Truth-telling at all?
If we could control it. So they say art is a way of conveying stuff about, right, perspectives on reality.
Experience.
Right, and experiences that...
Real or imagined, or...
Right, that we should tolerate, we should tolerate and even encourage, because it is valuable to us to have more ways of looking at things, and for people to have ways of telling us things we don't want to hear. And Mussar just doesn't do it. Right, Mussar gets very conventional. Art also often gets very conventional. And we have to recognize that most of the arts that we tolerate will be, I think the notion that we have to allow art because every person has this creative impulse surging within them, that we need to find an outlet for visually, no. Most of the art people will produce will be Fiddlesman and just abysmal. Like most of the Fishy Tarot produced are banal at best and wrong at worst, right? But you have to... But there's a cultural value in having it. Now, there may also be subjective value to some of these traditions. But very few traditions have objective value. There, right? Nobody bothers to remember most of them. You know, very, you know, 0.001% of the Fiddushi Torah that are developed over time survives 20 years. So, I don't think that most of the art that is produced, let alone the art that is produced in elementary school, is of enduring value. Well, some people may enjoy it. The question is whether we think there is a real purpose in allowing people to express truth in ways, express what they see as truth in ways that make it a little bit safer. Right? Like we have grave difficulty with people writing essays about whether or not they believe in God and publishing them. Right, academic, right, coming with an academic essay, maybe God exists, maybe God doesn't. But we have more tolerance for a personal narrative about my faith experience. Maybe we have even more tolerance for visual representation of the experience, right, of the experience of religion, which involves sometimes not perceiving it. Maybe there are in a differentiated learning structure that There are some of us who would never get it if they just read essays, but there are things they need to understand that they can only get by looking at pictures. Now, need to understand is a complicated thing, right? There's some. Pardon? What are all the navies doing?
I mean, is the implication that the things that the navies are in front of are more likely than their opposites?
No. I'm not setting any hierarchy.
Okay.
I say a series of ibayasemas, perhaps. Now, part of this ties in. Let's say, like, I tend to think that it is a necessity for teachers of Torah to understand human nature as well as they possibly can. Because if you don't do that, then you end up being unable to properly affect your students. But by the same token, it's important for parents to understand human nature as well as they can. So there's always something valuable having a Torah. In anything that presents human nature honestly. The question that begs is whether it matters whether the presentation is quote-unquote artistic. And I don't know that I have a really good answer to that, because if I have a bias, you know, I want to privilege journalism also. And so it may be that, you know, for me, art is just a form of journalism that deals with different issues. Journalism deals with, on the whole, with objective, verifiable things in the outside world, and art could be a kind of journalism of the inner being on occasion. Although sometimes, like Guernica, right, the Casa de Guernica is journalism about the Spanish Civil War. So I want to play that out, right? I think there's a possibility of making an argument that there is a need which can flow out from Levino Harod if you want, of having access to as many sources of truth about the world, and that means specifically having access to things, right, having access to sources of truth that are not bound by the rules you set out to begin with. At the same time, there's a real value in a society in creating default settings, that, right, even enforceable default settings, and it may be that art is a way around that, because art's message, because when it's expressed artistically, it's never just about the message, it's about the form. And you always have your own options of interpretations put before you pretty explicitly. I think the film there is an excellent illustration of how the film just presents reality as it is, but it's very easy to take it as a whole set of messages, and none of those interpretations is wrong. So maybe there is a reason to create an opening for it, because it enables us to construct, right, to be more effective people that way. And part of its value as a journalism, like the journalism that is censored, is generally pointless. Because A, no one trusts it, and B, it can't deal with the, it can't critique the people who have power. What's the point of journalism that can only critique the people who don't have power? Because obviously the senators will be the ones with power. So by the same notion, it may be that censoring art on any basis other than simple formal categories is counterproductive, because it makes it impossible for it to be a real medium of truth. And so if we put in rules, we have to put in rules knowing that the rules are not going to be effective in ultimately controlling thought. Right? They can only be technicalities, and what they are, the rules are a way of conveying our values, knowing that what's going to be produced to some degree, sometimes it'll be glorious, if you know, the same way you get a student paper who really, really agrees with you, yay. But most, right, but there are teachers who assign papers, and everyone knows that the right answer is that one of the teacher believes, and so you get back lots of papers agreeing with you, and that doesn't mean anything. And then there are teachers who assign papers and genuinely convince their students. The teachers assign papers and say that you're free, and the students are right not to believe them because they flunk the teachers and disagree with them. There are teachers like me who assign papers and tell students that they're free, but many students learn fairly early, probably, that I'm generally happier with papers that disagree with me than papers that agree with me. On the whole, it's easier to get a good grade writing a paper that disagrees with me than a paper that agrees with me, probably. And then sometimes you really succeed in getting students to genuinely be free, and they write what they want. And when that happens, then the paper that agrees with you is really right is a source of joy. So the papers that disagree with you are real, and it, right, and it makes, and that's just, you know, you can claim that, you know, that's to some reason why we have free will, and that God likes that. I want to just suggest, however tentatively and poorly worked out, and without the halakhic language for it at all, that I personally don't go anywhere near as far as Rabbi Sarna in terms of what the necessity of art is. And I don't go anywhere near as far as we have a, are we online?
No, but it's 3:00, so I just want to
see what. You haven't reached him at all?
Have not heard back from him.
You've emailed him.
Right.
So, okay, so I'm going to finish in 1 second, then we're going to break for, but no one leave the building, so we can call you back. Right, so I say, don't leave the building for the next half hour, so if we get him, we can just call you back. Okay, or at least be outside. So I want to suggest that there is, that without going as far as Rabbi Sarna in terms of the necessity, the inner creativity, and without going as far as Rabbi Sperber in the notion that there is this tradition that we need to celebrate and validate within Judaism. I mean, it's not about the personality. Judaism per se has always recognized this, that there might be a different argument, which is more modest in some ways and more expansive in others, for saying that we should value presentations of truth, that we, right, in set up in ways that we won't necessarily, that we know in advance we won't necessarily agree with. And that maybe that justify certain types of freedom in art that we wouldn't grant in other spheres. Or maybe not. It's a very tentative argument. It's just, you know, I have certain predilections, and at the same time, you know, as often happens, the people who defend the people who defend the conclusions I want to reach do so on grounds that I can't share. So the question is, there another way of getting that? Okay, let's break now and let's find out if we can get Rachel. Does any of you have a cell phone that calls Israel?
Yeah.
You do?